Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock right now on this day, the 2nd of October, back in 1869. Mahatma Gandhi was born on this day. In 1950 on this day, we would see the first ever publication of a comic strip called Little Folks, which would later be turned into Peanuts by Charles Schulz. In 1955 on this day, Alfred Hitchcock Presents premiered on TV. In 1958 on this day, Guinea would gain independence from France. They would wait 10 years before declaring themselves a republic, which they did on the same day in 1968. In 1977 on this day, Niki Lauda would win his second ever Drivers' Championship, finishing fourth in the US Grand Prix. In 1980, Larry Holmes would make Muhammad Ali regret coming out of retirement in a brutal 10-round fight. 1991 on this day, Steffi Graf would become the youngest woman to win 500 pro matches in a tennis. And in 2016 on this day, Kim Kardashian would be robbed of $10 million worth of jewelry at gunpoint in a hotel. I wonder where her security was. You tune into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we take a look at the latest developments from the PIC. They gave us an integrated annual report for the year ended 2024. We're going to be taking a look at that report, trying to make sense of it and trying to see what the numbers are saying. Then we've got a conversation with Business for South Africa chairperson Martin Kingston around the latest pronouncements from the president that they are aiming to create 400,000 youth jobs in the next year and aiming to achieve a 3.3% growth rate for South Africa. Very interesting numbers there indeed. Then we've got a conversation with Alan Gray around investing for retirement in this new two-pot era. And then we wrap the show up with our executive lounge feature, as we do every Wednesday. We take a look at an executive and we try and get to know them a little bit better beyond their day-to-day. This week's executive is the CEO of A Simply Black Media, Kareen Hafiji.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As always, we kick off with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. It's been a very interesting day of movements, positive for the South African markets, not so positive for global markets. I'm joined on the line by portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, Nick Kunz, to take a look at this, try and make sense of what's been happening. Good evening, Nick. Lovely to speak to you as always. Looks like it was a good day to be holding JSE stocks, but not such a good day to be holding Japanese stocks.
Yeah, evening, Jimmy, and evening to your listeners. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it is a very sort of choppy period at the moment. There's lots of geopolitical risks to, try to figure out as well. But bottom line is, back here in South Africa, green on the screen, as you said, still the foreign flows coming in, a lot of positive sentiment, but offshore, not so much. We're about to head into U.S. earnings season as well, so that's going to make things also a little bit more complicated.
Nick, U.S. markets are having a good day today. They weren't a little earlier on and they weren't yesterday. They were all in the red. Now suddenly they're all kind of moving towards the green. I see NASDAQ and S&P both in the green at the moment. What's causing the choppiness? Because I'm looking at the U.S. on one side. I'm also looking at Hong Kong, which was up 5% while Sydney was down a tenth of a percent. And usually uncertainty then speaks to a gold price moving in the right direction or moving positive, and that's not even doing that.
Yeah, Jimmy, it is very, very difficult at the moment to try to dissect what is going on. So you're right. Normally you sort of get a weaker dollar, then the rand does this and gold does that, and you kind of figure it out. But at the moment there seems to be a lot of investors trying to second guess what's going on. I think also there's been a little bit of we call it left field. Out of nowhere, we had that Chinese stimulus package that was last week, Tuesday. So that's really sort of put the fire on the sort of Chinese equities. But on the flip side, you've had some geopolitical goings on in Japan. You've got a new prime minister that hasn't been very well received. So you've had a stronger yen. So that side of the world is not seeing a positivity there. And then, of course, the last couple of days, you've got to say that the risks have been ratcheted up with what's happening across in the Middle East, and that has certainly made that part of the world a little bit less sort of investable. So lots going on, but just to mention the positivity out of the U.S. in the last hour or two, There were some private payroll numbers that came out which were a little bit better. There was a bit of a bounce back after about 5 odd months of slowing down, and that is ahead of what's going to be quite a big one on Friday, and that is the jobs numbers and non-farm payroll numbers as well. So maybe a little bit of preempting those numbers in the next few days.
I was just going to get to that, Nick, to say, looking at those ADP numbers, do we kind of expect that we might actually see a positive NFP print? And if we do, Jerome Powell said this week they're not going to make any rush decisions on inflation. They're going to make them as the data comes out, or on interest rates, rather. They're not going to jump the gun around the rate cuts. We've sort of started to price in another 50 basis points, and he shot that down very, very quickly. Is there still any real concern that lingers within the U.S. markets?
It's such a difficult one because the Federal Reserve have made, and Mr. Powell as well, to your point, has made no secret of the fact that the jobless and the employment numbers is what they are looking at. You know, they've been waiting for it to weaken a little bit. You know, inflation has certainly come down, and the base case for a soft landing looks intact. But do you remember a couple of months ago, it was that jobless numbers that spooked the market, and we had that couple of days of a really sort of quick sell-off. We're sort of back there again, markets waiting for Friday's numbers. You know, I think with last week with the Fed cutting by 50 basis points, which was a bit of a surprise, you know, we're looking for 25. You know, you almost get the feeling that the MPC over there in America, the Federal Reserve, you know, they are concerned about growth. They're probably don't mind letting inflation run a little bit hot. And they, you know, I think they just, it's steady as you go. So I wouldn't be surprised if these jobless numbers do come out okay, and we do continue a little bit with this, you know, this risk on theme that we've seen recently. But nevertheless, nerves either way.
Nick, let's come back home for a second. While all of this craziness is happening, you'd think the local markets wouldn't be as crazy, but they're just as crazy. I mean, I'm looking at Pick and Pay up almost 5% for the day. Sibanye-Stillwater, 8.5% in the green. These are companies that when the risk-off sentiment kind of set into the market, nobody really went towards them, nor them. 3% or almost 4% today. Implats as well. Platinum pricing obviously playing a big factor here on that PGM basket price, and it's good to see the platinum price moving up. But I'm looking through just some of the big movers today, and it's the unexpected guys.
Yeah, Jimmy, don't jinx us.
We
take it when we get them. No, you know, we've been thinking about this and we're chatting about it amongst sort of us at work as well. You know, we've had, you know, South Africa's certainly gone nowhere for the better part of 10 years from an investment point of view. You know, we've been, a lot of the foreign flows have not come here for all the reasons that we know. But recently, there's definitely been, you know, this is 100 odd days since the GNU over the weekend, and there's been definitely a positive impetus. We've seen the flows coming in. We've seen SA Inc. bouncing back. And I think also taken against the context of the South African emerging market investment case, we're not as big as we used to be. You know, 20-odd years ago, we're anywhere near 10, 12% of that emerging market basket. So when a foreign money came in, you know, it used to quite move the needle. Now we're about 2%, Jimmy. So when foreigners put money to work, we're not a big number. But in South Africa, you put $100 million to work in the alternative, it moves it quite significantly. And I think that's what you're seeing. We see people coming into bottom picks shares, Sibanye moving 8% is, I mean, it's a big move, but on the scheme of things, on a global scale, it's not that big. But to your point, platinum shares are up, there's a little bit of risk on theme, and this SA story continues. As I said, please don't jinx it, Jimmy. Let's keep it going.
Nick, how much longer can we ride the wave? I mean, I don't want to sort of be the party pooper here and be the Debbie Downer about it, but we've seen in the past that South Africa's problems have largely been internal, and if we seemingly are getting those right, and I'm hoping that my conversation with Martin Kingston will be more confidence around that, then we should be in for a rand below 17 rand. Am I being too optimistic here?
I don't think so. I think there could be a base case. We could do. You know, those interest rate differentials are still there. You know, I was disappointed. I thought we'd get a half a point bump by the SAR, but we didn't. I think it's not far off, but we could see that. Look, I think at some point, though, Jimmy, you can't just, the good story's there, the tailwinds are there, the rhetoric is there, but I think you do need to sort of, talk the talk now, right? You know, we're going to need to see some positive growth coming through. You know, there's one thing having this flows coming in, but it's not going to you're not going to get the legs from it from 0.5% growth or 0.6% growth. We're going to need to get 1-3%. I mean, that's a big ask. But I think you're going to need to see that coming through. Otherwise, you know, the money, as soon as the money comes in, those foreign money can flow out pretty quickly if you don't follow up with those sort of reforms that everyone was talking about. So now I think the hard talks need to be had. And I look forward to that conversation later. I think it'll be very interesting.
Nick, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts around how we get to that number. The president put out a very big number, a very ambitious 3.3% growth for 2025. Analysts' expectations, the Saab's own expectations, don't even get to 2%. How do we get to 3%, realistically speaking?
Yeah, well, look, you've got to sort of aim high and hope to get there. But I think that's a bit of a stretch in the short term. But it starts with the basics. I mean, I think, you know, we've got some of the basics right. You know, energy. You know, we're getting constant energy. We haven't had load shedding for better part of 3 odd months. You know, that's the first port of call. Secondly, we all know the problems with infrastructure. You've got to get those right as well. I think they're working on it, and that's, you know, case in point. Unfortunately, some stuff is out of our control, though, because you need the world economy to carry on turning. I think we got a big help with the Chinese stimulus package a week and a bit ago, because they're now our biggest trading partner, and they're consuming a lot of the stuff that South Africa digs out the ground. So I think a lot of things are in play. But we now need to do the hard work, and I'm sure the presidency knows about that, and let's hope they get it right.
Let's hope they get it right, and let's hope that China stays on track with its plans when they come back from their holiday. We'll leave it at that, Nick. Thanks as always for the time and the insights. A lovely conversation as always. Nick Kunz, portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, on the market movements today and what could potentially drive sentiment.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's been 1 month since the implementation of the two-pot system, and billions have flowed out of retirement funds as investors withdraw from their savings component. Join the SAFM Market Update this evening at 6:45 as Alan Gray's head of retail, Tamron Lamb, discusses the potential impact of the new two-pot era on South Africa's retirement outcomes and explains how investors can improve their odds of achieving a comfortable retirement. Brought to you by Alan Gray, 50 years of long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized financial advisor.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And we go straight into that story and that conversation that we were touching on with Nick Kunz around the pronouncements by the government that we are expected to have a blockbuster of a 2025, to say the least, with around 400,000 youth jobs hopefully created in the short to medium term. I'm joined on the line by the chair of a Business for South Africa Steering Committee, Martin Kingston, to take a look at this and try and make sense of it. Good evening, Martin. Thanks so much for taking the time. 3% growth rate forecasted or expected by the president with 400,000 youth jobs created. Is that a realistic number or are we being a little overambitious here?
Well, Jimmy, good evening to you and to your listeners. I have to say we need to put this in context. This was, as you know, at the launch of the second phase of the government and business partnership, which took place yesterday. It was looked back in terms of what had been achieved over the past 12 months, the constraints that we'd had to deal with. And you'll recall that those constraints, which were focused on energy, transport and logistics and crime and corruption, were binding constraints on economic growth. So in the absence of load shedding, if we have a transport and logistics system that is working properly and we start to make real inroads into addressing crime and corruption, and in particular there, getting off the FATF grey list, which has really very meaningful implications for the credit rating, for the cost of capital, we think that the aspiration to get to 3.3% by the end of 2025 is achievable, but it's predicated, as I said, on maintaining the level of progress that we've already seen with respect to those three focal areas. By the way, in the case of energy, we're actually now past the 6 month, not the 3 month, the 6 month mark in terms of no load shedding. We've seen some improvement, but inadequate improvement in the performance of transport and logistics. We've set up the structures to be able to ensure that we can make really a very good attempt to get off the grey listing process in the course of 2025. It's only when we've achieved all of those three ambitions and everything else is continuing to point in the same direction, coupled with, I have to say, continuing commitments to an implementation of structural reform by the government and operational improvements, which the private sector can certainly assist in those three areas, that will see that sort of level of inclusive growth being achieved. And that's what, of course, in part gives rise to the broader aspirations with respect to jobs. I have to say, with regard to the youth, that's rather more specific, which is that what we're doing is we're working with government on leveraging existing partnerships for employment. I can elaborate upon them if you like. And that, we think, could give rise, if we unlock bottlenecks, to approximately 400,000 work opportunities for youth. That's by the end of 2026.
Martin, you've touched on a couple of things here, and I want to unpack some of them, starting with the conditional aspects of us achieving those targets. I mean, 3.3% is a very doable target, I believe, by the strength of the South African economy. But again, as you alluded to this, quite importantly, a lot of it rests on other things that in the past South Africa and the government have proven that they haven't been able to get right. We finally got Eskom right, which we will take that as a win, but we've had some serious issues with transport and logistics in the form of Transnet and policy and all the other things that you've alluded to. How can we be sure at this point, whether it's for South Africans or even for international investors, how can we be sure that we're going to get it right this time around?
Well, I think that the last 12 months is actually very telling, Jimmy. The reality is that during that 12-month period, we saw real progress in the establishment of the National Energy Crisis Committee to implement the Energy Action Plan, some 10 work streams in which business is involved in some 8 of them, the establishment of the National Logistics Crisis Committee, again, a number of work streams where business is involved in some 70% of them, and the Joint Initiative on Crime and Corruption. We needed to have those three government platforms established, properly capacitated, suitable terms of reference in place, and appropriate resources both from government and from business to be able to ensure that we could start to properly implement critical interventions that were necessary, underpinned, as I said, by structural reform. Now, each of those three platforms are in place. We established the Resource Mobilization Fund on the part of business at the request of government and the presidency over a year ago. We've raised now some 250 million rand to be able to procure specialist skills and expertise which we're donating to the presidency. Many of those skills are already in place, and we've seen some of the results eventuating from them. We've had some 350 subject matter experts that have been occupied and working in all of those three work streams, 57 odd companies that have been contributing to interventions in power stations. So in all of these areas, I could elaborate further, we've seen real traction start to emerge. There's a question of actually maintaining and building on that. I also mentioned, Jimmy, you'll recall, structural reform. That market reform needs to be accelerated in phase two, certainly for energy. We need to be able to ensure that the power stations continue to have an energy availability factor above 64%. We need to boost the level of private sector investment. We already saw a significant number of gigawatts coming on stream during the last 12 months, fueled by the private sector. We need to be able to roll out the transmission network, maybe 1,000 kilometers of new lines over the next 12 months. All of that is required if we're going to maintain and sustain the level of confidence that we've got, predictable, reliable, and I have to say competitive inputs for infrastructure, in that case in energy. When you talk about transport and logistics, of course, it's even more important because there Transnet has been struggling, as we well know. It's got a projected baseline of 170 million tonnes per annum. We think that needs to be increased to at least 193 million over the next 12 months. We need to unlock some 28 billion rands worth of investment in rail infrastructure. And again, we need to implement structural reform in terms of expediting the final network statement and appropriate pricing schedules or tariffs for private sector investment, let alone the separation of certain aspects of Transnet into an infrastructure manager and the Transport Economic Regulator Board. Now, it sort of trips off the tongue, but the reality is that seeing will be believing. I think what we've seen over the past 12 months has been real and discernible, tangible progress, which has fundamentally moved the needle and improved confidence levels. And then the last area, as I mentioned, and again, I can go into this in detail if you like, is what we're going to do in the context of crime and corruption, but where our primary focus, as I said, is removing South Africa from the grey list in the course of 2025. Now, we're not expecting anybody to take it for granted that those targets are going to be achieved, but certainly based upon what we've seen in the past 12 months and by redoubling our efforts and by leveraging the resources both of government and of the private sector, I think that we've got a fighting chance to get there by the end of next year.
A fighting chance certainly sounds interesting, Martin, but I'm sure you can appreciate that from a South African point of view, there might be a little bit of scepticism given that in the past we've been told these things from government, that this is where things are headed and this is how things are going to be achieved, and a lot of the times that has fallen short. That being said, we will take the victories that have come over the last 12 months, and my parting thought or parting question to you then becomes, how do we ensure that we maintain the momentum? Because you've alluded to a lot of things that sound exceptionally expensive to roll out and that are going to require a lot of capital investment. How do we maintain attractiveness from a capital investment point of view and ensure that we don't lose this absolutely critical momentum?
Yeah, that's the key question, of course. You're absolutely right, Jimmy. And I have to say that there are some 3 points I'd make in response to that. The first is that structural reform basically unlocks the opportunity for private sector investment in an appropriately regulated manner. The second is we've got over 140 CEOs who've signed up to this process. And lastly, we've got a number of CEOs who are personally driving these individual interventions.
So it looks like there is a very concerted effort towards getting this done, which is a very lovely to see and very promising to see, especially if you look back at the history of the country. Hopefully, as Martin has alluded to, that the rubber does hit the road. The proof will be in the pudding, but we are here, and anybody that is looking to assist will probably be able to reach out to Business for South Africa and all the other players that are involved here. Martin, thanks so much for the time. Thank you for the insights and for giving us a bit more hope to be optimistic going into 2025. It's Martin Kingston, Chair of the Business for South Africa's Steering Committee, joining me to reflect on some of the pronouncements by government and the private sector in an effort to move SA forward.
And in your business news, Reserve Bank Governor, what's his name, has repeatedly said this and that, and policymakers are expecting rates to go up or down. With inflation somewhere between 0 and 100%, interest rate relief may come sooner or later. Who knows, really? The whatchamacallit slid into undefined territory based on the Duhigi being so-so, and the markets were hard to describe. Despite initial doubts, the outcome was a mixed bag. The rand was meh based on the US consumer prices, but sentiment towards the currency could be, you know, whatever.
You can't base a decision on imprecision. Ask your financial advisor about a guaranteed annuity from Momentum Wealth. Personalized certainty.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The PIC published its integrated annual report for 2024, and it had some interesting insights to share in the briefing that they had today. Our editor at MoneyWeb, Rake van Niekerk, caught up with the PIC's CEO, Abel Sithole, to discuss, amongst other things, the grey listing, the size of the JSE, and where the PIC would be investing in the foreseeable future. Let's listen in on how that conversation went.
The Public Investment Corporation, or the PIC, is the largest asset manager on the continent, and it manages assets on behalf of the Government Employees Pension Fund, the Unemployment Insurance Fund, and the Compensation Commissioner. The PIC released its annual report for its 2024 financial year, and it shows that its total assets under management grew by 3.6% or 95 billion rand to 2.7 trillion rand at the end of the period. As a company, the PIC also reported a profit of 271 million rand, which is 22% higher than the previous year. The company declared a dividend of 141 million rand to the government, as the PIC is a state-owned enterprise. The annual report also received a 6 consecutive unqualified audit opinion. Abel Sithole is on the line. He's the CEO of the PIC. Abel, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a good growth period for the PIC, both when you look at asset under management as well as the profitability of the company. So everything seems to be going well at the PIC.
Very much so. Things are going the way we want them to go. But of course, you will remember we come from a difficult period of time. But yeah, we can talk about that some other time. The answer to your question, yes.
We're going to come back to the previous period because there has been some developments there. But I just want to quickly start with the grey listing. You made several comments regarding the impact the grey listing had on the PIC and its ability to do transactions or invest outside of South Africa. And that is a problem many asset managers in South Africa have faced over the past few years since we've been on that grey list. Can you maybe just give us your account of exactly how the grey listing has made your life more difficult?
At a broader level, of course, it's more compliance to focus on those areas that were identified leading to the grey listing. And then from a direct PIC perspective, yes, it's compliance, but it's also certain specific issues that we need to focus on. For instance, there's a bigger requirement for us to look at politically exposed persons and to do much more focused assessment of those individuals, and also to largely be very mindful of where the funding that we provide goes to and where the money that comes back to cover the money that we've funded comes from as well, so that we do not become a conduit for illicit flows of funds. So that's the one instance. And then, of course, there is the other specific one to the PIC, where there's much more scrutiny from the regulators, especially the Prudential Authority, which considers us to be a SIFI, a significant important institution. And this relates specifically to our investments to financial institutions, especially banks, where we are now limited in terms of how much we can invest in banks. And if we need to go beyond that, we need to get special permission from the Prudential Authority. And to the extent that we can't, and for instance, the banks are performing, it means then we structurally underperform simply because we cannot be exposed to those institutions due to the now more stringent requirements that are being placed on us.
I wasn't aware of that regulation, because the PIC is the biggest asset manager or holding assets in listed companies in South Africa. And due to the size of the funds you manage, you are actually a significant shareholder in most of the investable companies on the JSE. What is the limitation of the PIC to invest in banks?
It varies, except for special situations where, for instance, in the case of African Bank, we got 25% due to the nature of how the African Bank was rescued and we participated in that. It hovers around 17%. And if you go beyond that, we do need to get special dispensation. It applies to the PIC. I don't think it applies to necessarily other asset managers. It is something that we're working through together with the Prudential Authority and the client, the GEPF, to the extent that we might actually need to just revise our benchmark to accommodate that. But you are right, we are a significant investor, and that's the point that we make to the Prudential Authority. So please, next time when you meet with them, you can express the same view, because we share that view much strongly.
Is there a maximum amount or a maximum stake you can take in one of the big banks in South Africa?
Right now, it is. It is not a number that is unique, so they don't apply a blanket number to all the banks. So for each case, we must actually make an application if we go beyond a certain percentage. And that percentage currently is about 15%. So to the extent that we go above 15% to any bank, we need to write to the Prudential Authority to ask for permission to go beyond that. And currently, it's on average, our highest exposure is sitting at about 17%. But as I say, we do have the ability to approach the Prudential Authority if we need to increase. But there is a limitation. I think currently they probably will be uncomfortable with us taking more than 25% of any bank. That's what I would think.
I think it's probably part of a broader question as well. Due to the size of the PIC, as I've said, you take significant stakes in many companies listed on the JSE. But the JSE is shrinking. We're seeing a lot of delistings. Is the JSE becoming too small for the PIC? Do you foresee any potential structural investment problems stemming from a decline in the number of listed entities on the JSE and the money you will have to invest according to your mandate?
The one that's easier to answer is the first one, because the second one, it can be politically difficult, but I'll answer both. So let's start with the easy one. I think the JSE is definitely becoming too small for the PIC as an asset manager. So I think diversifying away from the JSE would be a preferred option. Or the other option is to, of course, to make sure that the JSE grows big as it to what it was before, because this statement is not a statement about the JSE. It's about the size of the market that I think we're investing in. And to the extent that the market is bigger, we will, of course, want to participate in a bigger market. So that is definitely clear. So some form of diversification is quite important. And that's why investing in the unlisted environment is also quite an attractive area of investment for two reasons: that it diversifies your returns, but it also helps you to invest directly into opportunities to get both a financial and a social return. So I think the answer is yes. And then, of course, the second one is that the JSE is not the problem, but it's the market. As the market shrinks and there are fewer companies that are listed, it really becomes quite difficult for asset manager for ourselves to actually invest without exposing ourselves to undue risk by having to maybe invest in entities that maybe you don't want to, but you're participating in simply because the market is offering what it's offering you.
The PIC can only invest 15% of its assets outside of South Africa, which is a lot less than the 45% private asset managers can invest. Do you think that 15% needs to be revised?
It's actually 15 plus 5. So remember, there's a specific allocation for investing on the continent. So there's a 5% over and above the 15. So it's about 20% if you include the 5% that we can invest in the rest of the continent. I know this is a very difficult question, and the answer will be difficult too, in a sense that I think the private pension funds have been given the opportunity to invest 45% offshore. Empirically, you'll probably struggle to explain why another pension fund like the GEPF shouldn't. And I'm talking empirical, not any other reason. So the answer to saying, would it be attractive to diversify the GEPF into other markets other than South Africa? The answer is yes, I think it will be. Unless, of course, the market is growing. And I must maybe put this caveat to say that I'm not saying this ignoring or being oblivious of the fact that the GEPF and the PIC have benefited significantly historically from heavy domestic exposure. But it does mean that over time, the over-reliance on the bias to the South African market can pose significant challenges for both the GEPF, the client of the PIC, and the PIC itself. So yes, I think a higher exposure to investing outside of South Africa and the continent will definitely be desirable for both the PIC and the client.
There has been a big debate over many years about prescribed assets, and that is where the government forces pension funds like the PIC or asset managers like the PIC to invest in government projects. But it seems to have been put to bed, and the President and the Treasury has in many cases stated publicly that they don't believe it's the right way to go. But recently, Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi, the Minister of Health, said that the PIC would be approached to fund the construction of new public hospitals as part of the NHI. What is your perception currently of the government's position on prescribed assets?
So there are two questions that I think you've asked. The one is prescribed asset, the other one is the funding of NHI. And I must address them differently because they are different answers possibly. So the first thing is the PIC in its current mandates is a significant investor in private healthcare facilities, hospitals, especially also transformative type kind of investments in that sector of health. So we do invest in a number of private hospitals with significant number of beds. That has nothing to do with NHI. It is simply because we believe it's an area that we need to be investing in as part of our transformative mandate and, of course, to get returns for our clients. So we are investing in healthcare. So to the extent that it aligns to our normal investments in healthcare, we will, of course, look at that as an investment proposal. But to answer the question, have we been requested, approached to fund NHI? The answer is no, we have not been approached to consider funding NHI. And I presume even if it were to happen, it will have to be in line with the mandates that our clients have given us. And we will then invest based on proposals that are being presented in terms of viable projects that we can fund in that regard. So in terms of NHI, there's been no approach for us to considering funding NHI. But should people approach us and can people approach us? Of course, we can't say to people you can't or you can. We will look at proposals that are presented and consider what we do based on those proposals. So that's, I think, is the response on the NHI side. On the prescribed asset side, as you say, it is a matter that seems to be put to bed and then once in a while it rises. My sense is that South Africa, and I'm going to speak about South Africa because we forget that, yes, we're in a new dispensation, but there are certain empirical lessons that apply whether you talk about this era or a different era. The empirical reasons will remain to say that prescribed assets in South Africa were practiced. And by the way, South Africa was not unique because, again, that's the other mistake we make. We talk as if prescribed assets only apply to South Africa. There are other countries that participated in prescribed assets successfully and otherwise, and one has to look at each one of them to assess why it succeeded in some places and not in others. But historically and across the board, even in areas where one can say there was a measure of success. It is an empirical fact that returns were constrained by prescribed assets. Anybody will find it very hard to provide an argument cogently that would show that prescribed assets provided a significant higher returns. They won't. I think there are other areas where the social returns out of prescribed assets, I think, were better. We can give examples of where that was done. But then you have to look at a lot of other issues like the governance regime, the economic regime, the natural endowment, the human capital endowment to explain why it succeeded in those regions and not in others. And there are other areas where it failed dismally, including South Africa. And here there is historical work which was done before the previous prescribed assets were actually scrapped. And when you go back to study that and understand why, it was largely because it had actually served investors very badly. I think there was a humongous difference in terms of the potential returns that could have been made vis-a-vis the returns that were actually made because of investing in prescribed assets. And that's why prescribed assets were actually abolished. So if we now go back to prescribed assets, we would actually be going back to something that we know doesn't work.
Abel, thank you so much for your time today. That was Abel Sithole, the CEO of the Public Investment Corporation.
When it comes to offshore investing, your investments deserve first-class treatment. As the only global investment manager with roots in South Africa, we're here for you and everywhere for your money. 91, investing for a world of change. 91 is an authorized FSP. You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This segment is brought to you by Alan Gray, 50 years of long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized financial services provider. And we're taking a look at investments, especially when we're looking at retirement. We know that Two-Pot came into effect last month at the start of September. So it's going to be something that is sticking around with us for the foreseeable future. And it's obviously changed how we reflect on investments and how we looked at our investments going forward. I'm joined on the line by the head of retail at Alan Gray, Tamron Lamb, to take a look at this and try and see where to from here. Good evening, Tamron. Thanks so much for taking the time. Obviously, with Two-Pot coming into effect on the 1st, we saw throughout the month of September that there were a couple of withdrawals, a couple of companies, whether it's retirement companies, asset managers, reporting that they'd seen an increase in the withdrawal activity from pension funds. What has been your observations as Alan Gray around the investment industry and what's happening at the moment?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so, as you say, this system has been well flagged, these changes, but it obviously came into effect on 1 September. And just for anyone who's not familiar with it, although I think if you've been listening to anything financial services related over the last few months, you've heard a lot about Two-Pot. But really what changed on the 1st of September is that a portion of your retirement account is accessible in future years. And it's been defined as a savings component. And the accessibility is really two parts. The first is there was an upfront amount, once off, a kind of a seeding, which was capped at 30,000, after which tax would be deducted. And then on an ongoing basis, you're allowed to access one third of your contributions. So what we saw in September is that, you know, as it became available, you know, people who needed the funds thought, okay, well, now I can access this amount of 30,000 Rand, if 30,000 Rand or 10% of your value. So I would say, you know, Alan Gray's experience will be a little bit different to some of the other larger providers. From what I can tell, you know, some providers have seen north of 150,000 withdrawals, you know. Other providers will be somewhere between 5 to 10,000 withdrawals, and that's the sort of lower end of the spectrum and probably where Alan Gray would sit, just given the nature of our client base and that they're largely advised. But just to put that into context, because sometimes you throw out these numbers, that's a meaningful jump relative to what you would ordinarily see from a kind of a normal discretionary investment. And obviously these accounts, you've never been able to withdraw from them before. The one thing that was interesting for us is that we saw quite a lot of volume in the first week. It was almost as if people who really needed it were waiting for it, and they started to put in the kind of requests very quickly, and then it's really tailed off. So, you know, we're kind of getting kind of a much lower volume on an ongoing basis. The other thing that I thought maybe is worth mentioning, sorry, and I'll let you talk, it's just, it's not clear to us how people are spending the money. I know there's lots of commentary, but they could be using it to repay debt, they could be using it to spend, but I think it's way too early to tell.
Tamarin, when we look at the withdrawals aspect of it, obviously, as you said, different service providers would have different numbers that they're recording. I know, for example, the Government Employees Pension Fund said they had to the tune of 6 billion rands worth of withdrawal requests that they were currently dealing with. A lot has been said around whether or not people should be withdrawing from their savings. Take me through some of the pros and cons and why it might not be the best idea if people are accessing these funds at this time.
Yeah, so, and I'm going to, as I answer that, I'm going to give more cons to accessing this money than there are pros. But I'm also mindful that there are extreme scenarios in which people need to access the funds for sort of real emergencies. The sort of consequences are twofold. The first is that you are basically withdrawing from your future self. So let's say I'm 40, and unfortunately a little bit older than 40, but let's say I was 40 and I was going to retire at 65, and if I withdrew my 30,000 today, what that actually means is that I've got 100,000 rand less than I would have had at retirement. So you're sacrificing the sort of capital growth that you would have benefited on that contribution. And remember, when you make contributions to retirement products, you know, they are deductible and they're sort of tax efficient. So actually you're almost allowed to, it's a gross of tax contribution that you're able to compound. And that's the second consequence of accessing it, is that if you do withdraw, it is taxable. And what we have seen over the past couple of weeks is that that hasn't always been clear to the people who have been requesting the withdrawals. So that tax amount is taxed at your marginal tax rate. So actually, it could even sort of bump you up into another tax bracket. And if you have any outstanding fines or penalties with SARS, that will also get deducted. So unfortunately, we've seen some scenarios where actually the amount paid out in the end per SARS was zero, you know, having started out at an amount of 30. So those are the two real kind of negatives, that you are kind of withdrawing from your future retirement potential. So you're kind of taking away from your future self. And you can think about that in terms of the number of months you need to contribute now to make up for it, or you can think about it in terms of the lost value. And the second aspect is that this is not a tax-efficient way in which to kind of withdraw emergency funding.
Tamarin, speaking of emergency funding, what should investors be focusing on when we look at things like having an emergency fund in place or just adjusting your overall planning? Yeah. Where should investors' minds be sitting at the moment?
Yeah, you know, and I'm always mindful of just saying that we don't provide advice, and every person's individual circumstances will vary and be different. But if you believe that your retirement account is there for long-term compounding, you want to maximize the amount of money that you have in retirement and you can deploy at retirement tax tables, then you've got to say to yourself, okay, I don't want to take from my retirement account, but life does happen. And, you know, it is then important to build a bit of a buffer for yourself, so that you are not forced into getting, you know, very high interest rate short-term debt, or, you know, doing something more extreme like accessing from your retirement savings. So what do you do? You know, what we would sort of normally suggest is that you try and, you know, accumulate sort of at least 1 to 3 months of your current expenses into a low-risk unit trust. Let's say it's an interest fund or an income fund. That's going to preserve your capital over the short term, and it just gives you that peace of mind. So then you can, you know, your next contribution, you can say, okay, well, now I've got my emergency fund aside. You know, let's say it's 1 to 3 times my current expenses, and now everything else must go into my retirement.
This is why it's so important to speak to a financial advisor when you think about making these decisions, because every decision you make has some implications on your retirement. I think we'll leave it at that, Tamarin. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. This is Tamarin Lamb, head of retail at Allan Gray, on the two-pot and how to invest better going into your retirement planning. This segment was brought to you by Allan Gray, 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
Unleash your workforce's potential with Regent Business School, proud BBBEE Level 1 provider. Elevate your team's capabilities through crafting a future-ready workforce with top-tier accredited qualifications. Immerse your company in a culture of ongoing learning, paving the way to success. And what sets us apart? Regent's custom business programs are tailored seamlessly to your company's requirements. Visit regent.ac.za. Regent Business School. Be the future.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's the first Wednesday of October. It's also the first time we're going to be doing an executive lounge feature for the month. This week we are chatting to the managing partner at Simply Black Media, Karine Hafaji. We're going to get a sense of what she does and get to know her a little bit better. Good evening, Karine. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about Simply Black Media. When did you build the company? I mean, you've been in the industry for a while.
Hey, Jimmy. Thanks so much for this chat. The business is 14 years old this year. Really exciting for us. It started off as sort of like a little business that serviced clients in Namibia and Botswana and Zim and Zambia. After 14 years, we're in 35 markets. So really cool business. Really focusing on media and now creative. It's growing fast and it's really exciting.
Karine, how does one get into the media side of it from a communications and a strategy point of view? What kind of preparation goes into that kind of career? And is it where you thought you'd always be?
I wanted to be a lawyer. And after one semester, when I got home, my mom looked at my results and she's like, this definitely doesn't look like any subjects a lawyer would be studying, because advertising and marketing seems a lot more exciting. So it's a BCom degree for most people getting into the media business or into the advertising business. I have a 4-year degree, but you know, today we're so focused on digital media as the world shifts towards digital media. Not that many classically trained media people around at the moment. But yes, that's how I guess you get into the industry.
Karine, what do you enjoy most about your job?
I love the travel. I love the opportunity to see so many different countries. As I said, our business is in 35 markets. And unlike most people, I guess even as an African, we don't get to see this incredible continent. So we're really super lucky that we get to see the people and the places and really what the continent is about. You know, if you say to most people, have you been to Togo? They have to go, where is that? Is that in Africa? And I have that opportunity all the time. So it's an amazing job.
What do you like least about the job?
What do I like least about the job? Mm. I think being away from home, as much as the travel is nice and exciting, it is very demanding and everybody thinks that travel is quite glamorous. But I think the hardest part is, you know, the 3 o'clock in the morning flights and those things and still being, you know, getting off on the other side of a plane and trying to look glamorous and beautiful and be excited to be there. I think that's the hard part and the part I probably like least. But really the reward on the other side is incredible.
Karine, when you think about your business and you think about all of the years you've put into it and you look at where you are now, how do you strike that work-life balance between dedicating time to being with the family but also being a businesswoman, running a business, running an empire across so many different regions and giving everybody enough of yourself?
Tough. It's very tough. I think that, you know, if you want to run a business and grow a business at this scale, you have to make some sacrifices. You also have to have a really strong support network. I'm very lucky that, you know, my partner has been with me for a very long time and he's very understanding and, you know, we're able to maintain a relationship that works, even though I'm away from home often 280 days a year. But there's definitely sacrifices. I think it would be really tough to be a parent and I'm, you know, I don't have a family, I only have a partner. So I think that, you know, it makes it a little bit easier. I think that for any mom trying to do this, it must be very hard. I think, you know, I always think that moms are incredible and I don't think I would be able to do this if that was the reality. And I think work-life balance is tough. I think in running a business, I don't always know what that looks like. And I think it's making those moments, while there are not that many to be at home, there really have to be quality moments, focused moments where you say, okay, cool, this is family time and we're going to focus now and we're going to do just this one thing. So try and do more quality than quantity, I think. That's for me the secret.
Mm. Well, some would argue that being a business owner is like being a parent in that if you're building something for yourself, by yourself, it is quite similar in nature. Karine, how do you wind down when you're not thinking about work and you're not traveling? What's the go-to thing for you?
Oh, I love reading. So I'm like an obsessive reader. I read everything. I do read a novel or two, but I devour books. I love reading, love listening to podcasts, and I can listen to anything, whether it's on the history of something or whether it's a novel or whether it's, you know, sort of like a really smart podcast or whether it's about nutrition. I love those kind of things. And I really love walking, and gardening is my secret passion at home. But you know, you have to make time for those things. Otherwise, it can become quite a lot and can be overwhelming.
Mm. What's the most memorable thing you've read?
I'm reading Diary of a CEO at the moment, and I must say, it's really simple and is a bit basic, but I really love it. I love the fact that it sort of brings the basics to the fore and reminds us of them. My most memorable book, I'd say, is definitely Principles by Ray Dalio. You know, when you have to make tough decisions in business and you sometimes can get swayed by the sentiment or the emotion of the moment, if you can find a principle that you're aligned to and that the values of your business and your team, you know, are anchored in, I think that those are the things that work. So most memorable, definitely, I'd say Ray Dalio's principle.
Mm. Corinne, what's a meal that works for you? What's the one go-to thing you can't live without?
if you travel in West Africa a lot, those are interesting questions. Mine is a toasted cheese. I can always convince someone to make me a good toasted cheese somewhere.
Sometimes simple is better, right? Sometimes simple does make the most sense. Corinne,
a cup of Kinder toasted cheese.
Okay, that's quite interesting. It sounds very, very homely, so to speak, especially when you're traveling and you're so or out of the country as often as you are. Corinne, what's the favorite country you've traveled to? It might not have to be on the African continent, but I get a sense that it's probably on the African continent.
I think my favorite country ever is India. I love it because it's weirdly, it's similar for me to Africa. It's so diverse. It's so rich. It's so interesting. For me, I like spaces and places and people that are very diverse, that are fast changing, that are interesting, an assault on the senses in some way. It would definitely be India if it was sort of like a global destination. For me as an African destination, you know, it's a trick question because I know there are people in my team listening, so I'd rather not tell you which is my favorite destination in Africa because, you know, it's a favorite question in the team always.
Corinne, with work that you do and the areas that Simply Black Media kind of covers across strategy and campaign management and all of that, how do you get time to, as you said, listen to things like podcasts, but separate the work side of it? How do you switch off the, I'm listening to the podcast for the sake of the podcast and not necessarily for work or for research purposes?
I don't know if there is a switch off, to be honest. I think that for me, I'm a super eager learner. I think, like, you know, at the moment I'm learning about glucose and why that's important. And, you know, if you're on the wrong side of 40, as I am, or something on the right side of 40, I think that everything is an opportunity to learn. And I therefore can't say I really switch it off. I think that I'm continuously learning. And that in itself for me, in some ways, is a switch off, you know, whether it's, I don't know, I don't see it as a switch off necessarily, and I don't think you necessarily need it. I try and use it, you know, as proactively as I can.
Always an opportunity to learn and always enjoy traveling. I think we'll leave it at that. That sounds like a very interesting life, and it sounds like a very interesting way to spend your days throughout this interesting journey that is life. Thank you so much, Corinne, for your time, for giving us a bit more color around what it is that you enjoy doing and what passions drive you. That's Corinne Hafferty, who is the managing partner at Simply Black Media, joining us this week for our Executive Lounge.
My name is Louis Nell, and I am co-host of a social media channel called GCrypt. I will be on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast with Kieran Ryan talking about crypto scams and improbable investment opportunities, often using cryptocurrency. Most importantly, we'll look at some modern trends in crypto scams and how to spot them. Make sure you tune in.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
Hello, Jeremy Maggs here. I've just finished recording the next episode of Fix SA on MoneyWeb. I'm in conversation with the former chief executive of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange and soldier, Roy Anderson. We'll be looking at leadership style and approach when it comes to solving problems, comparing the role of discipline in military and civilian leadership and strategies for setting and achieving goals under pressure.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's been the show for today, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, we're going to put them up online. You know where to catch up on them. They'll be up on the MoneyWeb app. They're available online on moneyweb.co.za. You could probably find them on the SABC app as well. The show is streamed through there in the evenings and on every show's episode as well. If you've missed the conversations, go find them, go catch up on them. It's coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Host is going to be standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, until next time, good night.